Good morning. I'd like to open the House Committee on Business and Labor Monday, March 16th, 2015. I've got four public hearings scheduled today, and we're going to try to go in order. Although we may jump around for legislators that come and go. So with that, I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3164. Jan, would you give us a quick summary of...
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure modifies the meaning of the term change in a retailer's competitive circumstances. It clarifies the conditions under which the supplier may, with good cause, terminate, cancel, or not renew the retailer agreement or change the retailer's competitive circumstances. And it increases from 12 months to 18 months the length of notice the supplier must provide the retailer before terminating, canceling, or not renewing the agreement or changing the retailer's competitive circumstances when that retailer fails to meet marketing criteria. There are no amendments before you.
Thank you. And we have Steve Danner and Ron Moore. And was Roger coming up with you as well?
No.
No?
I don't think so. I think he...
It's a good choice.
I'm telling you said that.
Welcome. What?
No offense, Roger. So, well, good morning. If you'd introduce yourself before you give your testimony.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ron Moore. I'm president of the Pacific Northwest Hardware and Implement Association. We're located at 3857 Wolverine Avenue Northeast here in Salem, Oregon. And the association was founded in 1899 in Spokane, Washington. Its purposes were the same in 1899 as it is today, to represent the interests of the hardware and implement dealers.
Chair Holby, my name is Steve Danner, and committee, I represent Ag West Supply, legal name Polk County Farmers Cooperative. Our original location was in Rickreall, Oregon. We have five main stores throughout Western Oregon. We employ about 150 employees. We were owned by about 5,000 farmer producers that live throughout the state of Oregon. And I'm in support of HB 3164.
Do we proceed?
Certainly.
Chair Hall, you members of the committee, association is in support of House Bill 3164. It's intended to add clarity to the Oregon Dealer Protection Statute to ensure that the person interpreting this law understands that the terms of the dealer agreement do not determine whether there has been a substantial change in the competitive circumstances of the dealer. The fact that a dealer agreement allows an act of demand or omission does not determine what such act of demand or omission resulted in.
If you could pull the mic within about 8 inches, we can hear you.
Better.
Is that better?
Yeah.
I apologize. You want me to start over?
No.
I think you're good. I could hear the first part.
Could you hear the first part?
Okay.
was that the welcome, Representative Holby? Is that the part you heard? So one of the purposes of the Oregon Dealer Protection Statute is to prohibit suppliers from substantially changing the competitive circumstances of the dealer without good cause. The statutes do have provisions for good cause in which the manufacturers can change or terminate a dealer agreement. For example, a dealer agreement may state that a supplier can approve another dealer to operate right next door to the original dealer, even if the supplier knows that it would not have convinced the original dealer to invest millions of dollars had the dealer known that this was the supplier's intent. This provision was not intended to be limited to preventing actions by the supplier that would violate the terms of the dealer agreement. Dealers already have a breach of contract remedy in that situation and therefore don't need additional legislation to address it. These statutes were originally passed in House Bill 3406 in 1991, and we're here today just to update those statutes. So I don't think it's a discussion on whether we need these statutes or not. That's been established. We also will be offering some amendments to these statutes, which you don't have currently, but As drafted by the Legislative Council, they added more provisions than we thought were necessary, and therefore we want to address those conditions that we didn't ask for. So, and I have copies of those that I'll give to Dan. So that's pretty much where we're at, Representative Holy, Chairman, members of the committee. I'd take questions.
Does anybody have questions? Representative Barreto.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill stemmed from, I think, one of the equipment manufacturers coming in. Could you just explain a little bit more about this? Because I'm a manufacturer myself. We have dealers and reps out there, and there are requirements put on them. And I'm just wondering if this is to prevent, you know, kind of changing the rules in the middle of the game.
Chair Holvey, Representative Barreto, you could say it that way. Let me paint a picture story for you. In 2013, Floyd A. Boyd, a dealer in Merrill, Oregon, basically Klamath Falls, was getting ready to sell his John Deere dealership to another John Deere dealer. He's also an AGCO dealer, had the Heston and Massey line of equipment from AGCO, had 60% market share in his trade area, and AGCO came in and gave another dealer his Heston and Massey line of equipment, and that changed his competitive circumstances. He, therefore, his value of his dealership is obviously diminished, and finding another buyer was going to be tough. So that's kind of the story, and that's what started this whole process. And we think that state statutes were clear, that the supplier disagreed, and that's why we're here today, to clarify the statutes. Does that help?
Thank you. Thanks for asking that question.
Other questions? So before you go, so this is sort of you have a territory, I assume, as an equipment dealer that you sort of depend on as part of your economics for your little region. And so what this bill's talking about is having a manufacturer come in and just carve it up completely differently than it has been. And
Representative Chair, hopefully members of the committee, let's talk about that a little bit. The dealers have what they call an AOR, an area of responsibility. That area is not exclusive for sales. If I'm competing with Steve Danner, I can sell into that trade territory. That would be a restraint of trade to stop that. But what has always been understood in the dealership dealers is that area is where they will have their locations, and that's not going to change unless, according to the statutes, there's good cause, the manufacturer can come in and say, well, for cause, we can now change your competitive circumstances, i.e. put another location inside your AOR. Typical good cause provision that might work in that case would be if you didn't have your market share, right? And the statutes address that. But to say that another dealer can't sell in your trade territory, that's not quite correct. They can sell. The competition's right there.
So it's a matter of just them physically,
yes,
moving in another,
yes,
branch.
Yep.
Okay, great. Other questions? I appreciate you getting up this early on a Monday morning and coming down to get us started. And I'll let you get on with your days. Thank you very much for your testimony today.
I'd like to testify.
Oh, would you like to?
Yeah,
oh,
like
I thought you were done.
No.
Okay. Go for it.
Bear with us.
The reason that I'm here today is I'm sitting on the dealer side of the desk. And I can relate to Representative Barreto because I was with the manufacturer for 27 years before I came to Ag West Supply, and I've been here about 8 as the general manager. As part of our sales and service agreement with all of our major vendors, we have a sales and service area or area of responsibility that we're held accountable to. And we have to hit market shares and you know, we're judged on how well we do in that territory. We've been an AGCO dealer, Heston dealer, since 1949. So that's 6 decades of providing Heston hay equipment, which is used on a lot of farms today in the operation of grass seeds, grass hays, etc. And I don't think I'd be exaggerating if I said that Ag West Supply is responsible for building the brand of Heston in the state of Oregon. So in 2013, we receive a letter from AGCO, and I told you where our locations were, but we've got a location in Rickreal, we got a location in Madras, we got a location in Harrisburg. And this letter from AGCO, letter addressed from Georgia, announced that they were going to set up Massey Ferguson and Heston dealers in my case, Salem, Redmond, and Springfield. And so suddenly that brand that we'd been selling for six decades is being marketed and sold for, you know, by the same dealer in the same place. And so my answer to, you know, the linguistics for the original bill is being tested of whether that changed our competitive circumstances. But as the dealer, I can tell you that our margins have been cut in half just to try and get some share and some sales. You know, I've had numerous conversations with salesmen that says that we get blown out of the water because we go in with our normal margin to sell Heston equipment, and the new dealer is selling it so much less that we've cut our margins in half to compete. So I don't know how you can argue that that did not change our competitive circumstances, and that's why I'm here.
Thanks. Questions?
Chair Holby.
Representative Barreto. Yeah.
Are the these other dealers, I mean, if they start setting up other dealers in your area of responsibility, I mean, one, that would go against your contract as it's written. Is that correct?
I'm going to have to digress a little bit. AGCO Corporation has tried to change their distribution channel quite a bit, and they've adopted the Caterpillar organization as their distribution. They would prefer, you know, a dealer control a complete state or several states. In our case, Peterson Machinery is based out of California, and they now have the state of Oregon. Deep pockets, but that's the approach that AGCO has taken. And there is a history when they first started the association with the Caterpillar Dealer Organization that they called the equipment that they supplied to them Challenger. And for reasons unknown to me, that worked for a while, but then they changed their approach and decided to give the Massey Ferguson brand and the Heston brand to the Cat Dealer Organization instead of Challenger. So really, we're competing model for model, price for price. And there is no prohibition against them from setting up another dealer in the territory.
Follow up.
Is there a pricing structure on how they buy? If they purchase more volume in a year, do they buy at a better price than a smaller dealer?
I can't answer that definitively. We're told that we're on a parity, but one of the things that happened is Heston discontinued the manufacture of grass seed headers. So a big part of our business with AGCO Heston was windrowers. And so when they no longer made that header, our volume fell. And we don't sell AGCO tractors or combines. So our volume is down here, their volume is up here. So in a sense, that's how that Challenger operation gains an advantage. And it's huge, especially when you consider the whole state of California and Oregon.
I have one more follow-up.
So
also in a situation like that, if they are showing favoritism to another dealer distributor, then they could essentially starve another smaller distributor from shipments also, so the larger company gets priority on inventory coming in. Is there any of that going on?
I have friends throughout the country, and they're AGCO dealers, and I believe that that is a tactic. I can't answer. I don't want to get into the details, but
it hasn't happened to your company though.
No, right now we can order product and get it. Okay.
Representative Noss.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry if this question is obvious, but I don't work in your industry, so I'm. Could you explain why AGCO would do this to you?
The two major competitors with AGCO in the U.S. market is John Deere and Case IH.
Okay.
And New Holland. You combine that with CNH. But what AGCO is doing, and I can speak really intelligently on this because of my background, representing a manufacturer.
Help me understand the bill.
But they want full line representation, and they need a very healthy, strong dealer. And the CAT dealer organization, who they've linked up with, is all of that. So they're trying to move their distribution from small independent dealers to large Caterpillar dealers that control a state. Not a bad tactic. It's just that it leaves us in the cold.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Chair Holvey, Representative Noss, I might make a comment regarding the statutes. Manufacturers have the ability to terminate a dealer agreement if the dealer fails to perform. I think there's an expectation on both sides. The manufacturer has an expectation that the dealer should perform and will perform. The dealer has the right to have the same expectation, that the manufacturer will deliver quality products, make parts available, and so forth. So if the manufacturer determines that a local dealer is not getting his market share, then he needs to sit down and have that conversation and say, you're not getting your market share, we need market share, and let's do what we can together to get market share. And these statutes have provisions for that. And if the dealer does not get market share, then the manufacturer has the right to terminate. What this bill is addressing is the fact that they came in and arbitrarily changed the competitive circumstances without that conversation and without those statistics. That's the point.
Thanks for explaining that, because I wasn't understanding it.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Would it be possible for me to just add a bit to that?
Ask the chair.
Sure. Okay. we've got an AOR, and we're judged on our market share. So this geography is measured. But if this new dealer sells the same model and the same Heston product that we're selling, we don't get credit for that sale. Even though it was a Heston sale in the geography, they only give us credit for what our company retails. So...
Thanks.
Changes the game.
Representative Evans.
Just a comment and a very quick question that I think is a yes-no question. But the reason I was interested in this bill is it appears that this is a situation where small, independent folks are kind of being pushed out. And for somebody who, my granddad was a dairyman, and he actually had very good relationships with the salesman that would actually tell them which products worked, which didn't, and had relationships that actually helped keep the farm going that may not be present with a large distributor-type situation. So could this bill be characterized as a way to help keep the small folks still in the game as opposed to being run out? Is that a fair way to explain it?
Chair Holvey, Representative Evans, I don't know that I want to get into the discussion of trying to protect small versus big. I think it's more of a question of fairness. Okay, and the statutes are pretty clear about what's fair and reasonable when it comes to changing the dealer's competitive circumstances. If a small dealer is getting his market share and bringing the brand to the customer, then so be it. If he's not getting that done, then there's a path of which to correct that process. The other thing that I think we need to make clear is that these contracts can be changed by the manufacturer whenever they want to. And they're contracts of adhesion, meaning they're a one-sided contract. Therefore, if AgWest has been in business, as Steve just told you, for six decades with AGCO, if AGCO comes and says we want to change the contract, you're probably not going to not sign it because you have this investment, right? So you're going to sign it, and you hope that the statutes will prevail where they make their errors. And we believe that this was an error where they just arbitrarily handed out the contract and changed the dealer's competitive circumstances. So I want to be careful that we're not trying to say that we're trying to protect the dealers for the wrong reasons. I mean, I think there's expectations on both sides.
I'm just saying it's hard enough to compete, and in this case, if they can be fair, the small ones might have a chance to continue to compete, right?
Okay. Thank you for not having any questions to start with. They seem to be popping up. Representative Esquivel.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned that the CAT dealership, is that Peterson Tractor out of Reading that in turn bought Pepe out and in turn bought, I think, Halton Tractor? Is that the same outfit?
It's the Caterpillar. I guess I'd have to back up, and my world is mostly in agriculture, but in the industrial world, at one time, Pape was a Caterpillar dealer, and I hope I get the story right, so I apologize if I don't, but they traded the dealership with another CAT dealer for the John Deere industrial line, okay? So Pape today has the John Deere industrial line versus the CAT line. Where Peterson fit into all that, I'm not real clear.
One more question, Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When comparing this proposed bill to other states or compared to where we are right now, Oregon, compared to other states and statute that they work with, is this are we weak in this area? Are other states stronger?
Chair Holvey, Representative Barreto, we are first, I guess, to address this issue with changing the competitive circumstances in the nation. The other states have dealer buyback and protection statutes. Ours are pretty strong compared to some states, but this is a new language, a new area with regards to changing the competitive circumstances. That help?
Yeah, follow up. Yeah, we just dealt with this in California with one of our dealers, and it was quite a process. I mean, it took a year and a half to work this thing through, you know, going each step of the way to give them every opportunity to increase their sales. And finally, you know, it came to the point where we could say, no, we're going to replace you. But but there were quite a few steps in the process.
But you did the process.
We did the process. Yeah.
Thank you. Gentlemen, I appreciate your testimony this morning. Interesting topic. We've got a few other people to listen to. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Representative Bentz and Representative Hoyle, I assume you're here to talk about this particular piece of legislation. Otherwise, you wouldn't be hanging out for so long.
Fascinating committee goings on in this business and labor.
Hot topic. Hey, this is an interesting combination, not something you see every day.
You'd introduce yourself for the record.
Representative Cliff Bentz, District 60, here in support of the bill. And just extremely briefly, the record should reflect that as an attorney, I've represented many dealers over the 37 years I've been in the law practice, and was asked by several to bring this bill. I have not spent a great deal of time studying it. I will simply say that to the extent we can clarify things in these contracts, that's a good thing. I will also say that in the years I've been practicing, I've seen a decided move, as we all have, toward bigger and bigger and fewer and fewer. And that's perhaps a trend that we'll never avoid. But it does seem to me that where we're dealing with situations involving smaller dealers scattered out across Oregon, we need to make their lives as protected as we can, or we won't have small dealers anymore in small towns, and that's not a good thing. It's a bad thing. So I know we heard earlier that this is not necessarily to protect small folks. I think I disagree with that. I think it does protect smaller dealers. I hope it does, because I think they serve a valuable purpose and deserve as much clarity as we can place into their circumstance. It's difficult for me to come before you and testify in this fashion without knowing exactly how this bill works. I don't know exactly how this bill works. I'll simply say that I believe it does help the small dealers, and I'm anxious to help them if I can. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Val Hoyle, House District 14, and thank you very much for hearing this bill today. So first I'm going to tell you what I believe this bill does, and then I'm going to tell you why I actually care about it. So House Bill 3164, Oregon Equipment Dealer Protection Law, prohibits farm implement suppliers from having a material detrimental effect on the dealer's ability to compete with another dealer who sells the same line of equipment without good cause. The good cause provision is defined, those are defined in statute, and the law originally was intended to protect dealers from changes imposed by a supplier if the changes are substantial and negatively impact the dealer's business. So House Bill 3164 provides clarification to the original intent of the Oregon Equipment Dealer Protection Law, prohibiting suppliers from substantially changing the competitive circumstance of the dealer without that good cause. It also clarifies the current statute relating to the time periods for contract termination of a dealer agreement by the supplier. So that's what. So the why is because with some of these small dealers, I represent West Eugene and Junction City. I have constituents who are employed in these with these dealers, and I also have farmers in my district that are serviced by these dealers. Also, previous to my career as a legislator, I worked in both for retail organizations, managing retail operations, and then worked in manufacturing. So retail organizations for 13 years, and then for 12 years in manufacturing distribution. So I've both had to comply with these types of contracts, and I've developed, enforced these types of contracts, set up territory, sales territories, worked with shops, both some who are successful, some who were not. But what we always did was gave our dealers a fair shot to say, these are the rules. If you can hit your sales goals, if you can give good customer service, if you can make sure that my product is sold the best way possible, then as a manufacturer, we did better. And consumers did better because they had the best possible service. And what I found was when I was fair to my dealers and we gave them every possible chance, and I think as Representative Barreto says, sometimes that doesn't work, but you do go through a process. When that happened, customers got the best service, and we felt like we had the cream of the crop. And part of that meant having territories that allowed that dealer to make enough money to make it worthwhile for them to sell my product. So I think that this clarifies in statute that dealers should be treated fairly, but again, can be the manufacturer can stop that dealer from selling their product with good cause. The other piece that's in here is that there is a rotating contract provision. You can have a manufacturer change the contract without the agreement of the dealer. And that's not fair. That's not right. And you can say, well, the dealer could just stop selling the product. Well, if that is your main product line, you actually can't. If that is the bread and butter that you sell, for instance, I worked for Trek Bicycles, and for many of our dealers, that was the main line that they sold in their shops. If we took away that line, that shop would actually not be able to continue an operation. So, you know, the manufacturer has a lot greater weight in a negotiation, and all this does is clarifies that there should be fairness in terms of how those negotiations happen. And I would encourage you to support this bill and bring it to the floor.
Questions for this panel? Thank you very much. One of the things you brought up that we didn't spend a lot of time talking about was the potential impact this has on service to local businesses, local farmers, I guess, in this mm-hmm. case. Do you see this bill, you know, protecting more service to local communities, potentially?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my hope is that it would. In watching what's been happening across the dealership area, I would simply say that there's a move toward consolidation that's hard to slow down. Competition forces that, I'm guessing. But it does make life very difficult for those in the farming business when they're down to three or four different folks to select from. And there's lots going on in these contracts. There's a lot of activity inside one of these contracts, most of which I don't understand without going back and studying each one carefully. But I will say this, to the extent we can make the statute clearer and somewhat protective of those who are they have their lives as dealers tied up in these things, sometimes multi-generational. It's sad to watch as they disappear. And so to the extent I can help them, I'm trying to do that. I think this bill does that. I hope it strikes an appropriate balance. That's why I'm supporting it.
And I think just I worked with dealers, bicycle dealers throughout North America, Europe, Asia. And what I can tell you is when a dealer of a product feels like they're invested in the product that they're selling, when they know that they have a commitment that they're going to have that dealership for a certain period of time, then they're good at their job. And again, most of the businesses I worked with, they're very, very committed to offering the best service possible. They pay more attention to ensuring that it's a very competitive market. And in many times, you know, you're not going to be able to compete just on price. You're going to compete on service. And so the best dealers will work to ensure that they give the best service to the customer. But if they're not sure what kind of longevity they're going to have in their dealership, if they're not sure whether or not they're going to have a competitor put right next to them, if they're not sure what kind of service products or that they're going to get from a manufacturer, they in turn are going to be less invested. They in turn are going to be less likely to want to hire more people. They in turn are going to be less likely to want to give the best service to a customer because, again, they aren't invested in the product that they're selling. So I think that what this bill will do is, you're exactly right, is it will allow our local farmers to get better service. It will allow our local businesses to feel comfortable enough to be able to maintain and increase the number of employees that they have.
Thank you very much. Representative Barreto, another question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. If a larger dealership, not in that area of in a different area where the smaller dealership, if they came into that area, just not landed there, but just sold into that area, and say they sold it at a very reduced price to force that dealership out or to purchase that dealership or force them into selling. Is there any protection here on pricing? You know, some manufacturers, they won't deviate in price. I mean, you can look at this product anywhere on the internet or in a store, and it's always the same price. And so they protect their smaller dealers by basically demanding that if they lower a price, they're no longer a qualified dealer. Is this an area that you're trying to take this?
To the best of my knowledge, this doesn't do that. First, Chair Holvey and Representative Barreto, sorry. Didn't mean to not follow the formalities.
And we are formal.
It's early.
Committee.
It is early.
Fully noted.
We take rules very seriously.
To the best of my knowledge, it doesn't really address that. You have to be careful because you can't have price fixing. I mean, that would be against a whole set of laws. But there are some manufacturers that do have a suggested price, and we have seen, again, in the industry that I was in, where you would have some dealers come in and try and buy market share for selling something at a lower price than it really was worth, and it upset the market greatly. We would not do business with those dealers because it undervalued our product and it made it difficult for other people to maintain their market share. So technically, as you read it, it could say, you know, you don't want suppliers to have a material detrimental effect in a dealer's ability to compete with another dealer who sells the same line of equipment. So that could be part of what's done here, but that isn't the exact focus of this bill.
Thank you. Really do need to move on. Yep. I'm glad there's no more questions of this panel.
Sorry for using all the words, and thank you for your time.
Thank you. I really appreciate you coming in, though. It did definitely help bring some clarity to the issue. Up next, I have Paul Cosgrove and Drew Hagedorn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul Cosgrove representing John Deere. We are not the company that was just talked about in terms of causing some of these problems. John Deere has competitive circumstances clauses in its contracts. Current law requires and addresses this issue. Our concern, I'll just say it simply at the beginning and then try to explain why, our concern is this bill, we think, causes more problems than it solves. If you have the bill in front of you, the key change is on page one, mm-hmm. and it's the change in a retailer's competitive circumstances definition. And what the change is now a change in a retailer's competitive circumstances, the instances in which it competes in the community, means an event, act, or omission that has a material detrimental effect on the retailer's ability to compete. All that's current law. Whether or not a retailer agreement allows or provides for the event, act, or omission. What that means, I think, in common language is if the parties have agreed that the competitive circumstances changes they're concerned about, whether it's a new dealer moving in, a change in product line, any of these possibilities, they can provide for that in their contract. What this bill would do is prohibit them from negotiating those terms. The reason that is, I think, important is if you go to page 3 of the bill, there are a whole series of changes, bold language on lines 36, 37, 38, having to do with competitive circumstances, and on page 4, also on lines 9 through 13, 17 through 20, and 27 through 31. I defy any of us to be able to describe what those changes actually do. We think this bill actually adds confusion to the issue. What we would suggest is a better way to approach the problem is to take a look at, are there specific instances that you would like to address and address those specifically, rather than saying the parties can't negotiate this in their contract, any change in competitive circumstances. We think that makes this area more difficult in terms of our relationships with our dealers. We want our dealers to succeed. Obviously, if they don't succeed, they don't sell our product, and we can't sell it directly. We don't sell it directly. We depend on them to do so. So we need to have good, healthy, productive, profitable dealers. We just think this bill doesn't get to that result and actually makes the situation somewhat worse. So for that reason, we request that you either take this bill and define it with specific circumstances that you wish to address, or leave it for the negotiation between the parties and their contracts. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Kinnemer.
Again, I'm sorry. On page one, what were the lines? I didn't get it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kinnemer, page one, lines 9 through 12 is the key change. There's lots of bold material in the first couple pages of this bill. Most of those are the grammatical changes that legislative council does in all of its bills. The key substantive change is the change in the definition of a retailer's competitive circumstances, and that the difference now is you cannot, as parties to the contract, address that issue in your contract. That's what's being changed by those lines 9 through 12. Thank you for the question.
Representative Evans.
Yeah, I just have two questions. One is, how many John Deere tractors are made in Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Representative Evans, none are made in Oregon. They're made there's a lot of sold in Oregon. It's my understanding our factories are mostly in the Midwest. We also sell internationally, and so we have some international factories as well.
So the follow-up question is, most are still made in the U.S.? They're not made in West Germany?
Mr. Chair, Representative Evans, my understanding is the great majority of them are made here. The ones that are sold here are made here. There are ones sold in other countries that are made in other countries.
Okay.
Mr. Hagedorn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Drew Hagedorn appearing today on behalf of the Association of Equipment Manufacturers. We represent about 850 construction and agricultural equipment manufacturers and suppliers. I'll just kind of rely on Paul's comments and our written submissions because I know you're running a little long on this topic, but I think Paul did a good job of summarizing what some of our concerns are on this topic, and I'm sure he and I will be making the rounds to visit with all of you to discuss that further. So thank you for the opportunity to appear today, and thank you for receiving our testimony.
Right. Any further questions of this panel? Not seeing any. I look forward to seeing the amendments and seeing if there's some way we can solve some of this problem for, because I am concerned about the locality of equipment dealers in the state of Oregon and, you know, in terms of providing service to our businesses. I think they've raised an extremely important issue that we need to pay attention to. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That short little easy bill is no one left to testify on it. So with that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3164. And Representative Davis, are you ready to testify on a bill so you can move on with your day?
Absolutely.
So I will temporarily jump ahead and open a hearing on House Bill 2893.
We're going to make you sit here.
Thank you, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. State Representative John Davis, House District 26, from the beautiful metropolis of West Lynn, north of Salem here. Thank you very much, and happy Monday. I'm pleased to bring you the most revolutionary bill you will hear all session today that will single-handedly alter the savings of every Oregonian in the state of Oregon.
That's not true.
How's that to wake you up on Monday?
We were looking favorably upon the bill. But.
Yeah. Now, lowering expectations a little bit, Chair Holvey, members of the committee, House Bill 2893 would authorize both banks and credit unions in the state of Oregon to offer what are called prize-linked savings accounts. And this is the third session in a row I've brought a bill. I think this is maybe the fifth session this has been brought. The key difference for those of you who are on the committee, return members of the committee, is that now federal law authorizes banks to also offer prize-linked savings account under federal legislation that actually passed through Congress and was signed by the president at the end of 2014. So we're in a slightly different landscape than we have been in previous years. To remind the returning members and to give a little background for the new members, prize-linked savings account really focuses on behavioral economics and the fact that for emergency savings accounts, the lack of an immediate return on investment, in particular in this low interest environment that we have in the financial industry right now, many individuals are not saving and are not creating emergency accounts and are not creating base amounts of savings in their savings accounts simply because they see no return on investment. And in fact, on the flip side of that, as you look at survey research, in particular for low-income Americans and Oregonians, many of them have said that they believe that participating in the lottery is one of the ways that they could really gain financial stability and become rich. It's very interesting as you look at the stats. So the idea of prize-linked savings is it both protects the savings element of every dollar that an individual might put into in a savings account. And I want to be clear, this is a savings account. There is no risk involved in terms of the lottery side. But it combines it with the potential for a return on investment, so to speak, immediately that the lottery provides. And here's how it works. Those who participate in prize-linked savings deposit a certain amount either each month or every other month or every few months. And in return for that, their money, let's call it $25, is saved in an account that's fully FDIC insured. In many instances, it's a certificate of deposit that cannot be taken out for 12 months. And in return for that investment, they're given the opportunity to participate in a monthly or a bi-monthly drawing for a larger pot of money. And that pot of money, for example, in Washington, who operates PriceLink Savings, is actually fronted by the financial industry. So if you have 100 people who might invest $25 each, they each get one opportunity for each $25 investment to win, so to speak, the prize. I think in Washington it's every 2 or 3 months that the credit unions actually pool together. And if you win that prize, you get the amount of that prize. And I don't know, right now I can't tell you how much that is. We'll have some speakers later, but I think it's in the $500 or $1,000 range for participating. So it's really combining the idea of savings with behavioral economics. And this bill, 2893, does not prescribe how the raffles, so to speak, the savings promotion accounts would operate. It simply authorizes them to operate. So in you'll see the bold is relatively short, essentially confined to the first page and a half, because it's simply authorizing legislation. To give you a little context, currently Michigan, Indiana, Connecticut, New York, Maryland, Nebraska, North Carolina, Washington, Maine, and Rhode Island have authorized PriceLink Savings Account, and they've gained some decent notoriety, in particular in 2014. Just on a quick Google search, as I was sitting watching the hearing, I noticed we have news reports. Hey, welcome. From the New York Times, CNN, U.S. News and World Report. Just in the last 6 months or a year. So we are gaining some notoriety here. And you'll hear some statistics from those in the industry who come up and talk about the characteristics of those who are participating in PriceLink Savings. I think by and large are those who have not saved before. And so we can say with, I think, some confidence that this concept is reaching those who we want it to reach, which are those who in particular have not saved and don't have emergency funds. In particular, the danger of not having an emergency fund, of not having a base level of savings, in particular for those who are low income, is that it simply takes one life event to be left destitute. It takes the car breaking down. It takes the sickness of a child. It takes a trip or a flight that you have to take to see an ill family member. And if you don't have that savings to back it up, it can really hurt your family, it can really hurt your life. And so this is a small step. I will take back what I said earlier. This is a small step, maybe not a revolutionary step, to incentivize some of the population to participate in savings. And with that, I'll turn it to my trusty friend and sidekick, Representative Reed.
I'll determine.
Thank you, Chair Holmey.
Welcome, Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Tobias Reed from Beaverton. Happy to be here with my friend, Representative Davis. You can decide if I'm trusty. I'm glad that he's decided that I can be his sidekick. On this bill in particular, I think it's something that we can all get excited about. You've already heard probably more than enough from me about the importance of savings in another context. This is another example, and one of the few downsides of following Representative Davis is he took several of the examples I planned to talk about in terms of a car repair, a medical emergency, a trip that one might not be planning for. We've seen this concept work really well in some other states. He may have talked before I came in about Washington, where in a year 950 accounts were opened in six credit unions. Over half of the people who own those accounts said they had not been regular savers prior to opening their what's called Save to Win in Washington, that account, and an even higher number, 81% in that group, said that they were financially vulnerable. So we think it's a really important thing for people to get started on. And there's strong evidence that when someone starts saving, they're likely to continue it. So giving this, making this tool and this approach more possible, I would say it may be small, it may not be revolutionary, but revolutions can start with small steps. And amidst all the other things we're doing, this would be a place where we can all come together and be very, very proud of what we do. I appreciate you hearing the bill and happy to try to answer questions.
Thank you. Questions, Representative Doherty?
I have two questions. One, this, unlike past legislation, applies to all financial institutions, banks, and credit unions. Okay. Number one. And number two, I just had a question about some of the language in the bill. In Section 2, it says it does not repeal or modify existing state laws with respect to gambling, except that the savings promotion raffle is not subject to existing state laws with respect to gambling. So what does that mean? If it... Yes.
Chair Holvey, Representative Doherty, thank you for bringing attention to that. So you may recall from previous sessions, Legislative Council has raised some issues because the constitutional prohibition on anybody but the state operating a lottery is rather strong in Oregon compared with other states, that constitutional language. And so the point of this language is the financial industry worked with Legislative Council to make absolutely clear and you'll see that in some of the limitations mm-hmm. on the conduct of a promotion raffle. Can't predetermine a winner, arbitrarily remove, disqualify, disallow. That language is meant to clarify that this is not a lottery, and it is authorized, but it's not a, a lottery that's being operated.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification.
Other questions? I'll save my questions for the next panel. Appreciate
thank you very much.
Appreciate your testimony this morning. I guess we'll go ahead and finish this bill. Pam Levitt and Jim Morrell. Merrill.
Morrell. Yeah, right the first time.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Pam Levitt, here representing the Northwest Credit Union Association. We're here today in strong support of House Bill 2893. I really want to thank Representative Davis for his leadership on this issue and the strong support of Representative Reed and Representative Kenningeyer. I've been, as Representative Davis said, I've been working on this bill for several sessions, and we finally think we've got it to a place where it's ready to go, and so I really appreciate all their leadership. Representative Davis really spoke to the heart of the issue and what I submitted in my testimony, and I've learned in my many years here in this building, the longer you talk, the more votes you lose on a bill. So I'm going to just briefly make a couple points from my testimony, and then I'm going to turn it over to a credit union in Washington State who's actually implementing the program, and you can learn from him. So PrizeLink Savings Program was piloted in 2009 in Michigan based on a Harvard Business School professor who did some research on the difference between people who play the lottery and people who do not have long-term savings. And PrizeLink savings accounts were created to incentivize those consumers to start saving and building financial strength for their future. Credit unions in the United States have a long and rich history of setting up these PrizeLink savings programs. As you heard, it works. One-year certificate of deposit with low balance threshold. You can deposit $25 in January, $25 in February, and add up to your CD and be entered into a monthly, sometimes annual drawing. And this gives those of modest means the opportunity to not only save at small dollar levels, but the opportunity, obviously, to win a prize. After Michigan set up the program, there were really incredible results. And I put that in my testimony, but 44% reported household incomes of $40,000 or less, and 16% reported household incomes of $20,000 or less. So really, in short, the program was successful in reaching the demographic that we were trying to reach. Doorway to Dreams, which also submitted testimony, is a national nonprofit that works to work with financial vulnerable consumers. And they are in strong support of this bill, and they talk about in their testimony how PrizeLink savings products have proven to engage financial vulnerable consumers in the act of saving and helping them build their financial security. Over 60% of the Save to Win account holders are financially vulnerable, and the product's account rollover rate is impressive at approximately 80%. Representative Davis talked about the states that have a variety of PrizeLink savings programs, and other legislatures are considering this program. I have someone from Washington State who's going to talk about his program, but Washington State rolled out the program in April of 2013. By the end of 2014, Washington Washington State's Save to Win program totaled 1,344 accounts in which members collectively saved a total of $1.3 million, averaging over $1,000 per account. So not huge numbers, but certainly growing numbers for people who probably have not had accounts in the past. Also, Representative Davis talked about how Congress recently passed and President signed the American Savings Promotion Act. This bill has been in discussion for many years, and I'm just thrilled to be able to bring it to you. I'm excited that Oregonians who may not have savings accounts will have an opportunity to save, and I'd like to turn it over to Jim, who's going to talk more about his program in Washington State.
Representative Kinnemer, question?
Thank you. Question first. I see the language is financial institutions.
Yes.
I presume that that's all financial
absolutely.
Institutions?
Absolutely. And that's the same in Washington State. I'm not familiar with the other ones, but we absolutely support all financial institutions having access to this product.
And a second comment.
Very good.
Thank you. I like this bill, and this, for the most part, I'm opposed to lottery, and certainly its expansion. However, this does just exactly the opposite of what lottery does, in my view. Lottery is about making people poorer. And unfortunately, we also know that mostly the poor play the lottery, which is a double bang. And this bill, it's nice to see the average account go to $1,000, which would be a very substantial amount for a lot of the people playing. And so that's my comment.
Go ahead.
Good morning, Chairman Holvey and members of the committee. My name is Jim Morrell. I'm president and CEO of Peninsula Community Federal Credit Union. We're headquartered in Shelton, Washington on the Olympic Peninsula, and we're excited this year because we're celebrating our 80th anniversary. It was some of our founders, the seven gentlemen from Rainier Pulp and Paper Mill back in 1935, that came together to form our credit union with the hopes of providing an institution that would be able to provide other coworkers the ability to save money in a safe environment. In 2013, our board of directors passed a community development mission statement, which in part reads that whether low to moderate income or wealthy, unbanked or underbanked, by educating to create a personal development plan, we demonstrate our care to enrich their lives. For the Olympic Peninsula, the communities that we serve, these commitments could never be more important. In four of our five counties, the average household income is more than $10,000 less than the state average. The Pew Foundation Economic Mobility Project found that 71% of children born to high savings but low-income parents move up from the bottom income quintile over one generation. In comparison, only 50% of children from similarly low-income households whose parents do not save see a brighter economic future. Americans' personal savings rate has declined about 56% over the past 50 years, according to the 2013 economic report to the president. In 2012, the annual savings rate in the United States was just 4.1%. More than 40% of American households lack the savings to cover basic expenses for 3 months, should an unexpected event lead to a loss of income. The benefits of prize-linked savings were derived from research conducted by Harvard Business School professor Peter Tufano. I had the good fortune of meeting Dr. Tufano as a participant in the Financial Service Innovation Think Tank, and one of the takeaways was that there is a correlation between people who play the lottery and people who have no long-term savings. As one step to pursue our community development mission statement, Peninsula Credit Union began offering a Save to Win account almost 1 year ago on April 1st, 2014. This offering allows members to open a one-year certificate of deposit that currently pays 0.30%, which is 5 basis points higher than the one-year certificate. The opening balance can be made with as little as $25, and each additional $25 deposit, up to 10 deposits per month, is another entry. An individual may only have one account statewide. Every month, there's at least one Peninsula Credit Union Save to Win depositor who wins $25, and statewide, 10 winners each receive a $50 prize. In addition, there are quarterly $5,000 prize drawings for those participating in the Save to Win program across the state of Washington. Should the need arise for a member to withdraw early, there is a nominal $25 fee to close the account, but that fee is not intended to be punitive. Instead, it's to give someone pause about changing their intent to save money. At the end of February, the first 11 months of Peninsula's Save to Win program, we've opened 291 members with deposits of just over $500,000, averaging $1,773 per account. Peninsula Credit Union has had 24 winners, totaling $950. While we have not had the big $5,000 prize winner, I'm expecting that any quarter now, they've have been combined between $25 and $50 prizes. The beauty of PrizeLink savings accounts is that there is no way to lose your money. Your deposits are your savings. You earn slightly more in interest, and you have the opportunity to win cash prizes. In addition, there's a positive motivation for you to save money so that you have more entries to win. Here are some stories about our members, from our members, and their Save to Win accounts. Margarita started a Save to Win account to save for a family vacation. She wants to take her four kids to the Philippines to see her homeland. Jane said the reason for her Save to Win account is to help her save a little more, an opportunity to win some money and to earn a higher dividend. Also, having the penalty of $25 she shared with us will deter her from taking the money out early. Tyler began saving using the Save to Win account, knowing that he was soon going to need new tires for his car to get to his job. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. It's glad to be in the state of Oregon, just across the street where I went to graduate school at Willamette a couple of years ago.
Three or four.
Thank you. Appreciate your test. My questions. Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Pam, do the people that deposit the money in startup accounts, do they have the option? Is this a specific account where they have the option to play in this account or go into another account? And or does anyone that makes a deposit automatically fit into that?
Chairman Holby and Representative Barreto, it's totally self-directed. It's the individual's choice as to whether or not they want to open the account.
Okay.
So I'm assuming that the prize money doesn't come from the participants that are in this drawing or raffle as such. So where does the money come from, the prize money?
Chair Holby, each of the financial institutions that participates contributes to that overall fund. So in our case, we're contributing about $1,500 to $1,800 per year. And then that creates the pool of money from where the winnings come from.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, also the Northwest Credit Union Association, which does oversee both Oregon and Washington Credit Unions, has a foundation, and the foundation also supports that fund.
So I guess my point is the money is not coming necessarily directly from the account holders of the people that are entered into this drawing.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony this morning. Appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to leave with your staff Jim's brochure that it really tells the members about the program, and it's a really interesting read. So share that.
As long as it's not asking me to join his particular credit union. With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2893 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2958.
Mr. Martinez is back there.
Did you want to testify? I didn't see you signed up, so I will close the hearing on House Bill 2958 and reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2893. Mr. Martinez.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize. It's one of these Mondays where you're supposed to be in four places at the same time. So thank you for reopening the hearing and allowing me to testify on this bill. I will be brief. I do want to thank Representative Davis, Representative Reed, Representative Kenny Geyer, and Representative Helm, who have sponsored this bill and brought it forward. Those of you that asked questions about banking, I thank you for that. This bill has been around for a while, but now, as of December, due to an act of Congress signed by the President, as previous folks testified to, banks can now be involved in these type of activities, and we're looking forward to this bill passing and learning more about it and hopefully implementing it in our banks around the state. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I'll just note that it takes an act of Congress to get the Bankers Association on board, so couldn't resist.
Nobody knew what we're allowed, Mr. Chairman.
So, well, that was a rich comment.
Yes.
So appreciate your testimony. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
No offense, man.
They, unlike us, they have rules.
So with that, I'll close public hearing on House Bill 2893. Making myself laugh, and open up a hearing on House Bill 2958.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure provides that there's a limited license that a rental company obtains to sell insurance in connection with renting vehicles. It will also extend to rental companies' employees and designated agents. It becomes operative 91 days after the effective date, declares an emergency, and there are no amendments before you.
Thank you. Al Elkins, Therese Irons, and Tanya Peebles. Good morning. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Al Elkins with Catrala, Car and Truck Rental and Leasing Association of Oregon. With me today is, to my immediate right, is Tanya Peebles, Risk Supervisor for Enterprise Holdings, Alamo Enterprise, and National Rental Cars. And to my extreme right is Teresa Irons, Vice President of Dollar Rental Car. Thank you for hearing this bill, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This is a bill that we've asked to be introduced. We are a trade association of rental car and truck rental and leasing companies. The situation is presenting itself that technology has advanced and the mobility of our customers have required our industry to be more mobile and flexible to meet the demand of our the tech and the mobility. As a result, we believe that some of the laws governing our licensing need to be updated. Under current law, rental car companies are required to be licensed to sell insurance products that are incidental to the rental of motor vehicle. These are take it or leave it products, and we support the need to be licensed. The mobility of our customers means that they pick up a vehicle and execute a rental contract at a hotel or smaller airport with authorized agent instead of one of our employees. We want to make sure that the same licensing requirements apply to those authorized agents in addition to our employees, and we are proposing language to do so, so that our customers continue to be protected under these circumstances. We want to make sure that all of our employees are covered by the rules and regulations of the company license. Therefore, we have proposed language below to tighten that up. What House Bill 2958 does, it eliminates the confusion of whether or not the person selling optional insurance on a rental car needs an individual license. By requiring the Department of Consumer and Business Services to adopt rules for rental car companies to apply for a limited license to sell optional insurance, issue a rental car company limited license to sell a limited product line of insurance. Those two things we are asking the Department of Consumer and Business Services to do. The limited license issued for the rental car company then becomes a limited license for the employee or designated agent of the rental car company to perform any act that the rental car company may perform under the limited license be authorized to. That concludes my testimony. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Go ahead and listen to the rest of the panel first.
Any
testimony to provide, or you're no. Just here to help answer questions?
They are here to help answer questions, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Questions from this panel?
Sure.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to clear it up and to get a better understanding, the person that's selling, so the employee that's selling the insurance, previously had to be licensed to sell insurance in the state of Oregon, is that?
We've all been under the limited licensing title. We're simply just trying to clarify and make it clear that those employees are under the business limited licensing.
All right.
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this is there a problem out there? Is there the slightest suggestion in any official capacity that the license did not extend to the employees?
No, we're just trying to pass it. We've passed it through several other states just to clarify and make sure that there's no problem and just to clear up any confusion so that we don't have an issue down the line.
Follow up?
Follow up.
Thank you. This is not intended to be a hostile question. It just seems so obvious to me that the bill as written, even before this law, that the license would apply to the individual employee who's selling on behalf of the company. But has this been a problem in any other state?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
Just a housekeeping item.
Other questions? So I assume that the rental companies themselves are actually not the insurance carrier, that you're working with other insurance carriers, like an agent of the insurance carrier?
Yes.
Okay. Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, to follow up with Representative Barton's issue, then, is the bill necessary? Or why is the bill necessary?
We just would like to, that's a good question. We're simply trying to create a housekeeping item so that there is not an issue at all in the future with our employees having their own licensing. We're just wanting to make it clear that our employees fall under our business.
Okay.
So I appreciate your testimony. Are there other questions? I just have one last question. So Priceline or a company similar or a hotel or somebody else that facilitates getting car rentals, would they also be able to offer the insurance under your proposal? Or can they now?
They don't now. They're completely separate from what the car rental companies offer.
Would this bill allow them to do that?
That's not my understanding, no.
Some of the, we may have a small airport where employees of the airport may offer these coverages for the customers when we are not available, in those times when we are not there physically to be there to rent the car to the customer. But those employees would get training from us to offer these coverages. And again, they're take it or leave it type coverages. They're not required.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony this morning. Was there anyone else that wanted to testify on House Bill 2958? Seeing none, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2958 and open up a hearing on House Bill 2114. Jan, remind us of what this bill does.
Sure, committee members. This is the measure that extends the sunset for the tax credit for employer-provided dependent care assistance to the year 2022. Yeah. The committee heard this March 4th. We heard from Chris Allenock from the Legislative Revenue Office, and today we have people from the Office of Child Care.
Correct. And in our meeting materials, I believe the outline of questions that we were supposed to consider from LRO is included.
If it's not, it will be really soon. It's marked as Appendix D. You might have found it when we had the hearing earlier. Appendix D is from the tax credit report that Chris Allenock prepared, and it is the list of questions that the Joint Tax Committee is asking the policy committees to review.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Barton.
A question for you. I seem to recall that all of us have at least discussed or contemplated perhaps moving this to a different committee along with some other, perhaps Human Services. I gather that's not happening now. We're reviewing this in this committee.
We, Representative Barton, we actually did move the other child care tax credits to another committee, and this one got moved back to us because it deals with the employers as a
opposed to the employees.
Can we have the other one back? No, I'm just kidding.
At this point...
Sorry, I don't mean to confuse.
I could certainly ask the speaker what she would do with your request. So Sonia Svensson and David Mandel, if you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Chair Holvey, committee members, for the record, David Mandel. I'm the Policy and Research Director for the Early Learning Division, and I have with me my colleague Sonia Svensson from the Office of Child Care and the Early Learning Division. So I'm just going to provide a little bit of background, and Sonia is actually probably much more likely to answer most of your questions. The purpose of this tax credit is to provide an offset to employers who provide assistance to their employees in finding or providing child care for their dependents. And in this circumstance, dependent care is defined as child care for children up to the age of 12, children with disabilities up to the age of 17, and elder care. An employer can take a credit of $2,500 per employee with no cap on the number of employees, as well as 50% of the cost of information and referral services with no cap on the costs. The role of the Office of Child Care in this process is to certify through validation the provision of either dependent care or information about referral services. We do this with fairly limited administrative cost and receive no additional funding for administering this fund. We've also provided to you a list of the companies who are taking advantage of the credit, as well as their size and type of business.
Is that on the list?
That's listed as a meeting material, committee members, listed from, I think it's under David Mandel, meeting material. I will say it does not have the list, it does not indicate the name of the business.
It does not indicate the name of the business,
but it indicates the type,
the size, and the year in which they took advantage of the credit.
Okay. Are you finding it on OLIS meeting material for David Mandel?
And my what was the kind and scale of the businesses that were taking advantage of the credit, so that was information in that particular form. Another dimension of the credit is employers can pay for both on-site and off-site dependent care employees as part of their dependent care assistance plan, and employers may not use the claim for their own dependents. Employers can claim this credit if the amount of paid or incurred is paid pursuant to a... Employers cannot claim this credit if the amount paid or incurred is paid pursuant to a salary reduction plan or is not paid or incurred for services performed within the state.
So I see that one of the largest employers that takes advantage of this is from... Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. As a matter of fact, the largest. So this tax credit's available to out-of-state companies that I assume pay taxes in Oregon. It is why they're allowed to participate in this.
Chair Holvey and committee members, yes, that is correct. If they have employees in businesses that are located in Oregon, they can claim this tax credit.
But the my understanding is that the provision of child care services would have to take place in Oregon.
Other questions? So a question about the credit in terms of the referral. So what does that exactly mean if they're able to refer by saying, we have, here's a list of the child care facilities in this city, they can get a tax credit for just sharing that list?
No, usually, Chair Holvey, committee members, they usually contract with a child care resource and referral entity, and that entity then works with them to find child care or dependent care for their family.
So the employer refers to an intermediary agency, and then that agency works with the employees to find appropriate child care.
Chair Holvey, actually, Cynthia Herkus is here to testify today, and she can actually answer this question much better than I can, because she was our marketer for from 2003 until 2011.
So I guess I'm just trying to find out the difference between the referral and an employer who actually offers the child care services themselves. I mean, do you see both in this tax credit world?
Chair Holvey, when an employer has an on-site child care center, they probably would not use a child care resource and referral entity. However, if they have employees that have off-site child care and they're having difficulty finding child care, especially for a larger employer with many employees that need child care, then they would contract with a R&R, child care resource and referral entity, and pay them to help their employees find child care.
And so the child care tax credit would be for their cost in paying the intermediate company to help their employees?
That is correct.
That's what their credit is for?
Yes. So if it costs me $2,000 a year to contract with a child care resource and referral entity to find child care for my employees, then I would be able to deduct up to 50% of that cost.
Interesting. Not seeing any other.
I pass.
Representative Nose?
I'll pass.
You don't need to pass.
Well, I don't understand what I'm reading, so I don't want to ask. I don't want to ask a question that's stupid.
Never stop any of us.
That's our job.
All right. Well, now I'm going to go for it here then.
I can't believe you're going to.
It's interesting. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's interesting to me that there's, like, if you look at the data for 2013, which seems to be the only complete year, there's only 20 entities that are taking advantage of this, and they. There seems to be quite range in size. Like, I would say in a company with 2,000 employees or 1,500 is quite large. And you have many bigger than that, and then you have some that are super small, and the ones that are small are in the child care industry, which I don't know what to make of that. I just think that's interesting. And I hope someone can explain to me what's going on there. Maybe it...
Oh, you mean the fact that the child care services is category is collecting a tax credit for a lot
Of
employees?
I mean, that's curious to me.
Care to comment on how the child care services industry is collecting a lot of this tax credit?
The bulk of it.
In 2013?
Chair Holvey and Representative Noss, most of the businesses that collect this credit are small, considered to be small businesses. Child care centers and maybe some certified child care know about the tax credit, and so they set up a 129D plan, or actually it's a 125 plan for the employee, but it's a 129D plan for the employer. And this allows them to offer child care benefits to their employee. Mm-hmm. The best explanation I have for the number of child care entities that take advantage of this is because they know about it.
Right. Follow up, Mr. Chair. So I just want to follow up on the comment you made about small business. So I'm going to go with just sort of the sake of this discussion, anything under 60 is small. There are some on here with 17,000, 2,000, 5,000, 5,000, 2,000. Are they small because they're
subsidiaries of the? I mean, how does that? How does a business with 140 employees? How is that small? I think that's what I don't understand either, because we don't have the names. Well, it's here. I'm just looking at 2013.
And to clarify, this list is not specific businesses. These are sectors.
Chair Holvey, the list is specific businesses. And there actually were two questions asked, and one of them is that when we ask for the size of the business, some of these employers are national employers. So this is their employment, not in Oregon, but nationally. So the business that's in childcare that has 48,000 employees, that means across the United States. Okay. They may in Oregon only have 200 employees. And that's how many they're going to claim the tax credit if that employee is requesting it or it's part of their 125 plan.
That's deceiving. Representative Fagan.
This is, I think, just so that I understand, when Representative Nose asked about child care providers, I mean, I'm assuming the example is, because my son goes to daycare, lots of the teachers are also parents, and so their kids are also at the facility, and so it's on, I mean, I imagine it's because they know about the credit, and also because they are set up for the facility. It would be very odd to have somebody be a child care teacher, and yet they were supposed to go find child care for their kids somewhere else. So I think, that actually doesn't rub me at all the wrong way, because it just makes sense that that would be a benefit that you would offer, and particularly since these are not usually very high-paid employees, that to offer them the ability to have their kid there on site, maybe in a different classroom.
Chair Holvey, committee member, Representative Fagan, I think that's exactly right, and, you know, we know about who the early childhood workforce is, it's very likely that it's actually quite low paid, largely female, and with a high percentage that have their own children.
Representative, was it Barreto? No. Did you have a question?
No. Oh, I did, but
you can go first.
Okay.
I
would assume a bill like this, I mean, I think this, if I remember right, this started back in 87 or something like that, or early on. But I would think a bill like this is probably sponsored by a larger corporation. So most small corporations don't even know about this. Passes through the legislature. They take advantage of it. A few more people tag on to it. Is that typically how a lot of these things work? So people just aren't aware, like other manufacturers, other businesses aren't aware of this opportunity?
Chair Holvey, Representative Barreto, one note I would say is that we did at one point the Office of Child Care, and just also there's been a little bit of moving around since the Office of Child Care was previously in the Employment Department, and then as of 18 months ago with the creation of the Early Learning Division, it's now in the Department of Education. There was at one point a marketing campaign around this, and we'll have an opportunity to hear a little bit more about that as part of both some of this reshuffling as well as the changes in the entity that did the marketing campaign. We have not for the last few years had a marketing campaign around this particular tax credit.
Thank you.
Just so I'm understanding again, this is a credit that the employer gets. So it incentivizes the employer to make something available. It's not being given to the worker. It's being given to the employer. Is it a pass through?
It's a pass through.
It's a credit to the employer for providing assistance to employees.
He pays this out to the employee.
Okay.
Representative Kinnemer.
I get it. Thank you. Okay.
Yeah, I guess I wanted to follow up on that. There's an employee credit as well. That's a separate function that an employee may claim.
If the employer does.
If the employer does not offer this.
There you go. Oh, you only get one.
Yes.
Okay. All right, we go.
Okay. No one's trying to take advantage of your
time. Oh, here we go.
So. Representative Fagan.
Is there any auditing done on the affordability of the child care? Let's take Nike for an example. I've reached out to a few people that I know who work there, and they've told me that actually, even though they provide I'm assuming, obviously, you can't confirm or deny that Nike is somebody who uses child care tax credit. I'm assuming they are somebody who uses it.
Is there any auditing on how affordable they make that child care for their employees? I've talked to some Nike employees who say, yeah, they have it on site, but it's something that, you know, some certain level of Nike employees actually can't afford to use the on-site child care. So given they're being given this tax credit, is there any auditing of the affordability of that on-site child care for the employee?
Chair Holby, Representative Fagan, as far as I'm aware, I don't believe that there is any auditing of that particular issue.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Mostly just a comment that as we move through this process and look to make this better, that's something that I'd be interested in seeing, is if we're going to be providing this as a, you know, public subsidy or a tax credit, whatever you know, however you characterize it, that we make sure that it's actually an affordable form of child care for the employees it's intended to benefit. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And along those same lines, is there does the tax credit, since it covers the cost of the employer, is it capped at a certain price per employee that they serve, or is it just any cost that they have is eligible for the tax credit?
My understanding, Chair Holvey, my understanding is that it's capped at $2,500 per employee, but it's not capped at the number of employees.
Okay. All right. Not seeing any.
Chair Holvey, yes. Can I follow up on that?
Sure.
I think the question you asked was there a cap on how much that the company could charge for the child care? And no, we don't have anything to say about how much they charge. And I did want to follow up on a question that Representative Nose had. He was made a comment about the number of employers that are taking advantage of this tax credit. Our list only includes those employers who request a credit certification from us. They send us a letter. We send them a letter back. It's part of the materials that you have. There are many more employers that take advantage of this credit, but they don't come to us for the certification letter.
So they do not need a certification with the Oregon State Department of Revenue to actually get the tax credit?
Chair Holvey, my understanding is that there are many other employers that take advantage of this that do not come to us for a certification letter. And we have no control over how many employers or who takes advantage of the tax credit.
Thank you. Is there some other agency that provides them a certification?
Chair Holvey, no, there is not.
Thank you. Representative Nose.
Okay. Again, thank you, Mr. Chair. Now I'm confused. In another committee, we're dealing with a similar kind of issue. It's incentivizing health care providers to practice in rural areas. And it is incentivized. Like, you have to file a piece of paperwork. It's a more lucrative credit. So I'm curious about that, because then we also know that this one is not as expensive as the one that's being offered to the rural health care providers. I think that one's worth, this off the top of my head from Friday, maybe $10 million. And if I'm remembering correctly, we're spending about $1.5 million each year, maybe $2 million on this one. So we certify one and we don't certify the other? That doesn't make any sense. I'm going to start offering child care.
Follow up?
I'm sorry.
Not seeing any other questions for you this morning. Thank you very much for coming forward. Could I have up Cynthia Herks and Joel Fisher? Good morning.
Good morning.
Could you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Well, thank you, Chair Holvey and committee members, for this opportunity to testify on behalf of the Dependent Care Tax Credit. My name is Cynthia Herkus, and I am the person who marketed the tax credit from 2003 through 2008, and also was the primary I directly marketed the tax credit, and I was also the contact person from 2008 to 2011 regarding that tax credit and work-life benefits. The tax credit was marketed and promoted through the concept of work-life benefits, which in essence is let's help make home and family, home, work equal importance so that people are under less stress and more productive in the workplace. And I did give testimony about some of the benefits of the dependent care tax credit in terms of research that's been analyzed in terms of decreasing turnover, lowering absenteeism, and a variety of areas. And I did spend a tremendous amount of time, as I cited in the first paragraph of my testimony, talking with employers, giving information, attending trade conferences, et cetera.
Go ahead, Joel, if you want to. Go ahead.
Yes, Chair Holvey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joel Fisher on behalf of Oregon Business Association. We're a statewide association representing over 250 businesses across Oregon. This is just one bill of a number of other child care related bills that we're supporting. This bill in particular, is a tool that employers can use to make sure they have a stable, productive workforce. Often when you're hiring an employee, that employee comes with children, and this allows employers to help plan for that and provide a safe and stable place for their employees' children to be taken care of. And we're here to urge you to support this bill and extend this tax credit. Thank you.
Questions? So I'm curious. I would imagine most of the businesses that provide these sorts of services, I think we heard in earlier testimony that they're eligible to use this as a deduction against their income as well. So is the value of the tax credit separate from that deduction?
Chair Holvey, I'm here on behalf of DJ Vogt, who knows about such things, and so I will have him follow up with you. But when you start talking about taxes, I'm sure there are people on this committee that can assure you that I know nothing.
You handled that well, though.
Yeah.
Nicely done.
Chair Holvey, I'm sorting through the question you're asking. I'm not sure that I understand.
What I'm asking is that businesses that provide services to their employees for providing referrals to groups to line up child care or provide it themselves, I would imagine, take a deduction off of their income for those costs. So my question is after doing that, do they also get a tax credit for those same costs that they've already deducted from their income taxes?
Okay, so Chair Holvey, you're asking if they can claim the dependent care tax credit as well as write it off as a business expense. That is, they cannot do both. They can take the dependent care tax credit. That's one option. Or they can write it off as a business expense. That's another option, but that's not an option that I have a lot of knowledge of.
So when you certify a particular plan, how do you know whether or not they have complied with that particular piece of, statute?
That would be a question for the Department of Revenue, maybe the child. Yeah, I didn't track that as the business liaison, the person who marketed to
employers. Fair enough. I asked the wrong person. Other questions for this panel, Robert or Representative Nose?
So, I'm trying to figure out, like, if this is an effective tax credit. Like, again, who's utilizing it? It's not been very well advertised, all right? So, you know, and if it was suddenly well advertised, what kind of budget hole would it create? Like, I understand our job is to try to give some policy recommendation to another committee, and I am struggling to do that. I feel like I'll talk out of both sides of my mouth on this one. Like, we want to encourage employers to provide child care, but maybe some of these employers would do it anyway, and they don't need this incentive. That's what I can't figure out from the information that we have.
Thank you. Representative Evans, question?
Yeah, kind of a question for the group. Following up what Representative Noe said and the revelation that there doesn't have to be any proof to get this claimed, perhaps we could form a work group to discuss ways that if we do extend it, we track things in a way that we have access to tracking, and that there be some type of certification program. Just a thought, since we do it for everything else.
Thank you. Comment?
Committee, to respond to that, the rule is that they must be certified. However, businesses who hear about the tax credit and write it off on their income taxes, and that goes directly to the Department of Revenue, I think that's where there's a crack, if you will, that happens. So the child care division, it does require that certification, but there are people who hear about it word of mouth. Maybe they hear about it from a CPA, and they do not hear the part, or the CPA does not understand, or whomever. I'm not suggesting it's only CPAs, but they don't understand that they have to apply for the certification. So if they use the tax credit and it's, sent in, that's where I think it falls through. The Department of Revenue isn't tracking that.
I think I'd like to call Cynthia Herks and...
I am Cynthia.
Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry, Sonia. I was looking at the wrong line.
At least you pronounced it right, though.
Yeah. Back up, and maybe we can get Chris Olenek to come back up, too. Thank you very much for your testimony. It occurred to me we weren't quite done with our questions that were in your purview, perhaps. So we've asked a couple of questions. First off, the business that writes this off as a deduction, I think we kind of went down this road a little bit once before, is not allowed to also claim the tax credit. But how is that overseen? Is it purely a Department of Revenue that they, if the deduction is specific enough that it's claiming child care on the taxes, or is it required to be that specific on a deduction, itemized deduction?
Chair Holby, members of the committee, for the record, Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office. This is one aspect of a large number of pieces of the tax revenue system that I characterize as auditable items. So there isn't anything that happens prior to claiming the tax credit, but when the corporation claims a tax credit and if they are audited for one reason or another, then this is something that would come up during that audit. They certainly could be audited. For example, if the Office of Child Care were to share the list, I'm not sure if this happens right now, if they share the list of taxpayers that have been certified to claim the credit, and DOR takes that list and compares it to the tax returns, and there's an audit project on this piece, and then through that audit project, they might specifically look at this question to make sure that the companies claiming the tax credit are not also claiming the deduction. That kind of thing can also happen in any other kind of audit, because once a corporation or becomes under audit, then depending on the nature of the audit, a lot of other items can come up if they're looked at. Not everything can be looked at in every audit, because then businesses and taxpayers would be constantly under audit. But it falls under that category of auditable items. So the law is laid out that way. It's incumbent upon the taxpayer to know that they can't claim both. And then if they do, presumably that would be caught in an audit.
But as far as the tax return goes on the deduction side, it may not necessarily list this expense specifically.
Chair Holby, it's a business expense, and the businesses, and I think you have several business owners on the panel who might be able to talk to more specifically about how that plays out with the corporations and so forth. All of the employee compensation, all of the benefit packages, those are all expenses that they get to deduct.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Other questions?
Yeah.
For this panel? I brought them all the way back up here. So I guess I have another question. As far as dollar figures, how much money or revenue is spent on this particular child care tax credit as opposed to the other two or three, I think? the, just so I have a comparison of dollar amounts, because I think the other ones are more directly to the employees for the actual cost of child care.
There, in total, there are four child care related tax credits up for sunset: two consumer, one employer, and one that the funds are used to subsidize the providers. So kind of a provider, an employer, and two consumer. The employer, which is the one that you have before you now, historically we're talking about $1 million a year. It has varied in recent years, but $1 million for order of magnitude. The two consumer child care credits, one costs about $8 million a year, and the other costs about $22 million a year. The larger of those, the $22 million, is a refundable credit. That's part of the reason it's so large. And then the fourth one is a credit for contributions made to the Office of Child Care. And as I understand it, the office uses those funds. Those funds go then to providers. And there's a statutory cap on that. That is $500,000 a year. So between the four of them, the smallest would be Office of Child Care at $500,000. This one at $1 million. The employer at $1 million. And then one consumer credit at $8 or $9 million, and then the other just over $20 million.
Okay, thanks. That helps me put this into perspective a little bit. Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would think this would help a lot of the lower income people out there if employers were familiar with it. And also, on a simple 1040, like a lot of the low income people fill out, is there a spot on there to deduct child care when they fill out their tax return?
The Chair Holby, Representative Barreto. We're talking about the business.
Yeah, the employee. So if you have a low income employee, say he makes $20,000, $30,000 a year, and he qualifies for other types of social benefits. Is there a spot on his income tax, if he just files a simple return, to deduct child care from that? Or if there was the employee tax credit for this purpose too, if he was aware of that and took it, So I'm just kind of wondering, as far as the lower income employees across the state, which we're concerned about that right now, we're hearing a lot about that. If they're aware of that, and if they can deduct child care off of their taxes.
The employee cannot deduct the expense of child care, but they can claim these two credits.
If they're aware of them.
If they are aware of them.
Yeah.
Now, there is also a federal, one of the consumer credits is a piggyback to a federal credit.
So is that specific credit got a limit on it or a cap on it, or is it a percentage of the total expenses, or just
the Oregon credit has a cap? It is phased out based on federal taxable income. So taxpayers with federal taxable income above $45,000 cannot claim that Oregon credit. The federal credit is not limited. High income folks, as income, it is phased down. That's a percentage of the cost, and it doesn't phase out to zero. It phases down to 20%. So at the federal level, this child and dependent care credit is 20% of the cost of eligible expenses, is not limited by income. But the credit is higher for lower income people.
So the Oregon credit is limited for people that make less than $45,000.
Right.
Is there a limit on the credit? I'm not sure I heard that.
The expenses do have a limit. Therefore, if there is one dependent in the family, the eligible expenses. So the credit is expenses times a percentage.
I'm just trying to figure out how much do the employee gets to claim on the tax credit that makes less than $45,000.
The expenses are limited to $3,000 for one dependent or $6,000 for two or more dependents.
$3,000, okay.
And I think in the report that I provided, I have a table that shows the maximum credit that they can claim.
Okay.
And it's, for one dependent, is $3,000 times 30%, I think. So $900 for one dependent, $1,800 for two or more dependents for that particular consumer credit.
So it's 30% of the 3,000
for one, for the lowest, and those are for taxpayers whose federal taxable income is less than $5,000. And so the $5,000 is it's at particular measure of income, because somebody with $5,000 of taxable income may have AGI or wages of $20,000.
Okay.
It's an odd metric to use, so.
It certainly confused me. I'll have to take a look at that table a little closer, I guess. Other questions? Not seeing any.
Small business is not.
The other consumer credit is in Oregon only. It's the working family child care credit.
Right.
There is no cap on expenses there, and the maximum credit percentage is 40% of those unlimited expenses.
And that could include child care.
You gotta have.
Well, that is child care.
That is.
Okay. And so many taxpayers.
That's the $22 million one?
Correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
And most taxpayers claim both of those credits.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Appreciate your testimony this morning, helping us put all this in perspective a little bit. Don't see any other questions. Thank you very much. With that, I will close the public hearing. Was there anybody else that wanted to testify on House Bill 2114 before I close? Not seeing any. With that, I'll close public hearing on House Bill 2114. Any other business? No other business. I will adjourn the House Committee on Business and Labor.